Hey everyone, and welcome to the first of my two episodes from the 60th International Art Exhibition, the Venice Biennale. In this episode, we'll be exploring John O'Comfra's British Council Commission for the British Pavilion, entitled Listening All Night to the Rain.
Listening to the Rain, and I've kept this from people, but I'll tell you, you know, when I was very young, I used to love watching the rain. Very young. I used to love watching the rain, especially the thunderstorm-like ones. But I always had these blackouts because, of course, when it rained so violently, so quickly in the tropics, as we used to be called, basically the hot air came up very quickly from the ground. And if you're 4 or 5, you suddenly found your head in heat, you know? And I had very real difficulty processing heat, so I would black out, you know? So for me, rain was always like this, as a child, this thing, you know, that I was being warned to stay away from. As it starts to rain, like, get him away from the window.
John O'Comfra is known for his immersive multi-channel film installations, which explore issues including racial injustice, colonial legacies, diasporic identities, migration and climate change. The London-based artist initially came to prominence in the early 1980s as part of the Black Audio Film Collective, a collective founded in 1982. An early film by the collective, entitled Handsworth Songs, explored the events around the 1985 riots in Birmingham and London. And in recent years, O'Comfra's work has evolved into ambitious multi-channel installations presented in galleries and museums worldwide. In 2017, he won the Arts Mundi Prize, the UK's biggest award for international art. He has previously participated in the 58th Venice Biennale with 4 nocturnes, commissioned for the inaugural Ghana Pavilion in 2019, and Vertigo C 2015 as part of the 56th International Art Exhibition. Now, O'Comfra's British Council Commission for this year's 60th International Art Exhibition, Listening All Night to the Rain, continues the artist's investigations, but with a renewed focus on the act of listening and the sonic. The exhibition, conceived as a single installation with 8 interlocking and overlapping multi-screen sound and time-based works, encourages visitors to experience the British Pavilion's 19th century neoclassical building in a different way. O'Comfra's commission interprets and transforms the fabric of the space in order to interrogate relics and monuments of colonial histories. I was delighted to be invited by the British Council to attend O'Comfra's commission and to be offered the opportunity to speak with O'Comfra as he presents Listening All Night to the Rain in Venice. But very unfortunately, I'm unable to attend myself. But on the plus side, my friend, the brilliant arts writer Dale Burning Sauer has stepped in so that we can still get a flavour of this exciting event in the arts calendar. And Dale will also be writing about O'Comfra's British Council Commission for Shade Art Review. And you can find out more about Shade Art Review subscriptions in the podcast description for this episode. And I wanted to connect with Dale before she headed off to Venice. So let's hear what she's got planned for us. Hey Dale, so nice to speak with you just before you head off to Venice. I want to say thank you so much for covering this for Shade. I thought it'd be really cool to check in before you leave and talk about this particular commission for the British Pavilion. Now, for everyone listening who have yet to read around the commission, John O'Comfra has said this: Listening All Night to the Rain alludes to the performative power that the sonic will hold in the pavilion. The final ensemble of installations, iterations of acoustomology, detours back to questions of memory and of memorial, but from a different vantage point, questioning the architectonics of the present and the spectres of the past, with the idea of listening as activism in mind. And I really love this idea, this important sentiment of listening as activism, working in sound and art and representation myself. I'm obviously particularly excited about this since it's a lot of what Shade is about and what we relate to within our discussions here and the work that we do here. But tell me, Dale, I'm really excited to hear where you're at and what you're thinking. Is there anything specific that you're excited to discuss with a confrere? And also, it's your first time in Venice. So what are you excited about seeing?
It's a great honour and it's very exciting. Yeah, because it is my first Venice, but also because it's John O'Confra's work. I've been a fan for a long time. And although for this work in particular, right now I only have the title in itself is suggestive of an entire world of kind of paying attention, of bringing lots of different histories that have been overlooked or forgotten or erased into the present in meaningful ways, and really kind of listening to his work as much as to the world in which his work operates. So it's very exciting.
Fantastic. And are you planning on visiting any other things while you're in Venice, like particularly at the Biennale, and just what do you have in store like for your first trip?
Well, a list that's entirely unreasonable. Impossible to tick off everything on it. I'm really excited to see Elias Sime's new show called Dichotomy, organized by the Kunstpalast Düsseldorf at the Tanate. Shazia Sekander is at the Palazzo Sorano von Axel, and I love her work. There's a really interesting group show by artists from Southeast Asia, The Spirits of Maritime Crossing, which looks wonderful. And then there are, you know, big names like Peter Huja and William Kentridge, who will be in various different collateral shows, which are really exciting. And then I'm really excited to see Nigeria's National Pavilion and the Benin National Pavilion, both of which are being organized by incredible curators around themes that are really kind of interesting and rich. And then with artists, you know, wonderful artists. So it's going to be good.
It's interesting that you mentioned Nigeria Imaginary at the Nigerian Pavilion, because I'll be chatting with the curator, Andrea Emelife. It's her second time on Shade Podcast, actually, and she spoke to me as she was installing. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that conversation shortly. Thank you, Dale, and we'll speak when you get back.
Even before I knew anything of this piece, I loved it because of the title. Listening All Night to the Rain, just it resonated with me personally so much. But of course, beauty, as in all your work, beauty always comes with horror, with outrage, with pain. Was water and listening and the rain, was that there from the outset for this project?
Certainly, each one was there as a sort of separate entity. From the beginning, I didn't know that they would necessarily cohere into a triumvirate, you know, a holy trinity, if you will. But they were there from the beginning, because I always have this conversation with myself about which of the, you know, four elements. And I know this is complete, you know, nonsense for most people, but it does matter to me to decide in advance which of the elemental forces will be the over-determining ones, you know, air, water, fire, and, you know. And this felt immediately like a project about water. I knew, thinking about the building, that I wanted something porous, something borderless, something with bleed, something with fluidity, you know, so that the entire space, both upstairs and downstairs, had some amniotic relation, you know, with each other. That felt important to be able to build this symphony of a whole in parts, you know. And of the four elements, water seemed the most resonant of the possible vessels and vehicles of transport that we could use for this. So yeah, I mean, that was there. The other two weren't necessarily going to be in a relation with it. I mean, listening to the rain, and I've kept this from people, but I'll tell you, you know, when I was very young, I used to love watching the rain. Very, very, very young. I used to love watching the rain, especially the thunderstorm-like ones. But I always had these blackouts because, of course, when it rained so violently, so quickly in the tropics, as we used to be called, basically the hot air came up very quickly from the ground. And if you're 4 or 5, you suddenly found your head in heat, you know? And I had very real difficulty processing heat, so I would black out, you know? So for me, rain was always like this, as a child, this thing, you know, that I was being warned to stay away from. As it starts to rain, like, get him away from the window. Get him away from the window.
That's a foundational memory right
indeed,
there.
Indeed, indeed. So listening to it became, as opposed to watching it, became like one of the ways in which I experienced these incredible, you know, West African thunderstorms. You know, you'd be stuck in the house because they're all afraid that I have one of these febrile convulsions, you know. And as I got older, you know, I realized that, you know, actually now that I'm free to choose between looking at it and listening to it, actually listening to it was still my preferred, you know, way of approaching that mass of water, you know, and I still do. I close windows and sit and listen to it. But Shudompo's poem wasn't just about the serenity of listening. I mean, I think at the heart of it is an attempt to say something on the unhomely, on homelessness, being all at sea, you know. And those were as important sub-themes for this project as listening itself. You know, listening because I was interested in the sense of being transported elsewhere that listening always presupposes. And so the elsewhere was the important thing for me.
My immediate question was, at first, it's listening to the rain. I love the sound of rain. So the joy that you express, but then immediately also, but who is listening to the rain? Are they safe?
Yes.
Does this rain mean they've not had water for a long time? Does this rain mean they're going to drown? Mm-hmm. These questions about the perspective and this whole work does that so much. It pushes you into
Absolutely.
Other people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
It encourages mm-hmm. you to question
mm-hmm.
other mm-hmm. perspectives mm-hmm. constantly about... Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Beauty.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, rain in Anthropocene times isn't as marked by innocence as it would have been in colonial Africa in the 60s. You know, like it's not an entirely innocent act now. Either in the fulsomeness of its presence or its overwhelming absence. You know, somebody was telling me yesterday they were from somewhere where it hadn't rained like for a really long time. And the scale of devastation that implies is as important as when, you know, you've got rain that's basically covering everything. Like, you know, Dubai's sense of itself as this contemporary metropolis space was laid to waste 2 days ago because its kind of hubris was completely destroyed by flooding. You know, Dubai is, you know, one of those places on the planet which says we are so with it, we've transcended most of the sort of constraints of our modernity.
Including the weather.
Yes. And in one fell swoop, hubris is laid to waste, you know. So it does have that sort of voice of a threnody in our present. It's not entirely innocent, no.
That's wonderful, because you've answered a question I had, which was water and the idea of living water or water with memory. You've spoken about it explicitly in this piece, but it's long been part of your work. And I wondered what the source moment or the trigger point was, and the blackouts as a child, that could be one of them.
It's, you know, like there's this sense that you should, like when you've got a cup in a sink and it's filled with water, and then you look on the side and these shapes have been created by the overspill, which I kind of, wow, I think, oh, that's interesting. Why didn't I make the work about that rather than the top bit? You know, so I set off to do something about the process of water going into a cup, and then, but with the intention that there will be overspill and that the overspill will be just as interesting. And obviously part of the overspill now is that rain and water, rain creates surplus, and that surplus is tipping us even closer to that space we really don't want to be in now as a planet. And so the embodied threat that water also has now was almost certainly one of the sort of overspills that I wanted to be there. Like, you know, of course it has this aura of melancholy, and that's important and that's part of the piece, but threat is there now. We can drown and we can, you know, I mean, there's so many things I looked at for this. I thought, oh, we should get it in there, you know, places in the Amazon which floods, you know, where people can't grow food and all that. I was like, no, you don't need it. You know, we just, if you create the conditions, people will imagine it themselves anyway, you know. So part of trying to make this was deciding, and why it's been kind of quite difficult, is putting things in and then slowly learning to take them out, you know. I'm glad I did, because now it has a kind of haiku minimalism. I know it feels overloaded, but trust me, imagine what it was like before. I love the fact that it has this kind of, purity is probably not the right word, but a kind of minimal feel, you know. There's not too many voices, not too many musics in the traditional sense. It's just exists in this space of a kind of purity that I quite like now, actually.
I was thinking a lot about language. I was thinking about the way you've used the image in, it's not random that the multiplicity of images is organized in really purposeful ways, where you've got, sometimes they constellate into all these refracted images of the same one in a space. Other times an image swells to cover all the screens in one group.
Yes.
Other times you have these recurring motifs that are kind of conjugated in different ways from space to space. And it brought to mind language and an attempt at finding a language for those experiences or feelings where language and knowledge systems just aren't, they don't suffice.
No. It's weird, because one of the impact that Ezra Pound's work had on this, other than just giving us the names, is precisely that working method, you know. So if you read any of his earlier essays or the biographical details of him working with, let's say, T.S. Eliot, there's definitely this sense that you build things on repetitions, that you take things out to create these slightly vorticist shapes where things are being withdrawn, and then occasionally allow things to just be big enough to stand for a lot more than itself, if that makes any sense. And those kind of, if you like, montage devices, which are not really just about editing, it's also about how to configure space and how to think about narration, were very important for this piece, you know. And not all of it necessarily, you know, like, for instance, there, you get these characters or these movement shots, tracking shots, as they call them in cinema, across spaces where there's a figure or a set of figures lying down, and they've got either images or photographs and some set of artifacts around them. And I would shoot those things in classical way. So there'll be a wide shot, and then a kind of mid, and then a close. Decide then which of the closes to concentrate on. Oh, okay, we'll do the person's face coming in and out. Oh, yeah, it's a photograph, you know. But I then leave that to the team who put it together, you know. And sometimes the shapes are completely surprising, even to me. I'm like, oh, okay, so you didn't use any of the wide shots at all.
So it's a very collaborative approach.
Very much. I mean, you know, where things are just too much for me, I would say, okay, could we have this back? But in the main, I work with a team of people and I trust their instincts because, you know, you can't. You know, something like this, I mean, it's 3.5 hours to create. 6 screens, 3.5 hours. I say, imagine how many hours overall that is, you know. So you do have to defer to other judgments and other kind of interventions about how images that you've choreographed or filmed or can then be placed in some narrational form. You know, you have to trust that other people would also have an input and that's going to be valuable.
Yeah. You know? When thinking about language, I kept coming back to Arthur Jaffa's, who I know you've worked with often, his cudgel, that word that he reached for, and this idea that he'd reach for words that don't exist because the current words, the current knowledge systems simply are inadequate.
To cope with. No, absolutely. But, I mean, AJ trusts still, you know, the semiotic value of language in a way. I have to say I'm not quite as trusting. I mean, I love words and scratching around the impossibilities of them and seeing whether they can be recalibrated in certain ways, whether that means adding, you know, making conjunctions that then create new words or... But in the end, I'm, in this piece in particular, much more interested in the injunctions and the voices behind words as text, for instance. You know, so that if you had a series of texts, for instance, one saying white area, you know, that immediately comes with a tone of prohibition for sure, but also a tone of commandment, you know. This is a white area, which by implication, if you're reading as a person of color, literally tells you, do not go here, you know. So I'm kind of interested in textual arrangements and the implied injunctions, the implied voices, the implied tones behind those texts a lot more in this, you know, because, you know, when you set out to make something about voices, everyone assumes that it will be about the sonic or holy sonic, but actually a lot of the sonic resides in the visual, and part of the trick is all to find ways of unpacking that as well, you know.
And returning injunctions like that one to the realm of a person. A person decided to do that. A person wrote that on that sign, Blanca Dam, and that was somebody put that on the sign.
Indeed.
And then similarly, when you're going through your archival images and there's an image purposefully left anonymous of some, you know, a black man standing next to a white hunter, the black man is obviously made subordinate in that image.
Mm.
And again, encouraging or pushing the viewer to think, what was that man's name?
Yes.
Who was he? What was he thinking in that moment?
Quite.
Is that what you think of when you talk about listening to images?
Yes. I mean, because the listening is in a way part of giving us ownership of those images. You know, that guy, Mr. Tarzan, we call him, has been in 4 films now, 4 projects. I first came across him in our first visit to the Museum of Central Africa in Belgium, who've been supplying us with a lot of these images from the 1890s and 1880s. You know, he's been photographed a lot by several Belgian photographers who went to the Belgian Congo at the time. And he clearly was a larger than life figure who liked killing animals and sharing images of them in the company of his miners, servants or workers. The most extreme is this one where he's completely stripped and he's killed a stork and they're holding it, obviously, you know. And clearly what is going on is a certain display of masculinity as it's being formed. Because a lot of the times people talk about identities in relation to the colonial space as something fixed. It's like, oh, yeah, the white guys came or the white man came and then he did, you know. But the sense is that even that white figure is in transition. He's being made in relation to all the others because he's discovering the whiteness because he's next to all these black folk, you know. And they are there. They're a supplement to write this chapter of whiteness. That's what they're there for because they haven't shot the bird. They are props in this theatrical display of masculinity, of white masculinity, and their presence is absolutely central to that. And I wanted to find a way in which we can get people to own that, you know, as it's playing, which is why, you know, you think, oh, he's someone's dad. This guy went home with that bird, showed it some little girl, and said, look at what I brought from Africa.
Well, in one of the images, you have the man and then the family all seated and they're all dressed in Victorian white robes. It's just...
But I mean, the thing which happens, which is always interesting, especially with the Belgian Congo photographs in the 1880s and 90s, is that when the job of masculinity and sometimes femininity is complete, then they sit at their tables or in a bar when it's all white. And no one else. But in all the other spaces, you know, where you're trying to show mastery, colonial mastery, or a presence, a civilizing quote-unquote presence in the landscape, then there's always, you know, people of color around, usually functioning as props, quite literally. One of the famous tropes is you shoot an animal and then you have the gun and then your servants either holding up the animal or having it propped up and they stand by it, you know. And it's not that you're trying to say that they did it. It's not about inviting their complicity. It's about how they structure your mastery in your absence, you know. It's like, this is what I created. This is what I've done. And the significance, the brilliance and... is that I don't even need to be in it for you to see it. You know, that's me. I made that as the adverts. That's me, kind of thing. You know, so I'm interested in these moments in which one fixes on a certain kind of masculinity in transition. You know, it's not fixed, it's being made. And when it comes back to Belgium, by the time it gets to Belgium, it'll be something else. Now it's a white guy. But before that, it's not that. It's something else, which is... not. Anyway, I think you understand what I'm saying.
When John and I sat down to speak, I said I imagined his day to be perfectly packed. He laughed and said that was perfectly put. Back-to-back interviews, the ribbon-cutting ceremony, speeches, a photo call, more meetings, the evening party, when his gallery representative interrupted our interview saying she'd let it run over because it was so interesting, I still had a ton of questions, but I felt deeply grateful. John is the most generous interviewee I've ever had. That same generosity of spirit shone through when he made his own speech at the ceremony. I feel so blessed, he said. It was a beautiful moment.
Hey everyone, it's just Lou again. Thanks for listening to this, the first of our episodes from the Venice Biennale. Subscribe to Shea Podcast to listen to my next conversation with Andrea Emelife, curator of Nigeria Imaginary at the Nigeria Pavilion. the British Council Commission, Listening All Night to the Rain at the Venice Biennale, 2024 runs from Saturday the 20th of April to Sunday the 24th of November 2024. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Subscribe to Shade Podcast to listen to all the episodes in this series. Also explore Shade Art Review on Substack, joining thousands of art curious listeners like you who are discovering more about the work of visual artists from the Black diaspora. There you'll find art listings, comment, artist spotlights and guest posts, and free subscriptions are available. But for the full Shade Art Review experience, sign up today to receive 20% off your annual membership, an offer which is available for the duration of this series. This series of Shade Podcasts was produced and hosted by me, Lou Mensah, and mixed by Tess Davidson. See you next time.